Blog Talk Radio. Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach, always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then. And you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Oh, yes. Hey, I'm Carol Jurgensen-Sheets, Carol the Coach, and I am so happy to be with you tonight. You know, last week we couldn't get on the interstate. Let's try the internet. Goodness gracious. And I got to tell you, I was thankful that we didn't have a guest. I was going to be talking about Jared Fogle. For many of you who have been watching the news, you know that Jared Fogle is the subway guy, and he's based right out of Indianapolis, Indiana. He went to Indiana University, and very clearly, this man has a significant problem that I have to tell you, has brought up a lot of issues around sexual addiction. Now, I don't typically work with sex crimes, so although I have worked in a county and done all the abuse survivors and perpetrators and have experience with sexual abuse, pedophiles are not my specialty. And what I know about Jared is that he has a sexual addiction and he is a pedophile. And I was on the news 4 times in 3 days talking about it, you know. And so I felt like it was a wonderful platform to bring up what sexual addiction is and what it is not. And certainly I started almost every interview with, hey, a lot of people think that sex addicts molest kids, and the majority of sex addicts do not participate in exploitive sexuality. They are not exploitive sex addicts. They suffer from other types of sexual addiction. So it was an opportunity to educate the public on what sexual addiction is by talking about Jared Fogle and saying that the majority of sexual addicts are not pedophiles. And that, you know, was a good thing. I felt like we were able to do some good from a very sad story. You know, here's a man whose best friend and business partner was arrested by the FBI for sexual exploitation in April. And Jared had to have known. Of course, he's innocent until proven guilty, but he had to have known that he participated in the collaboration of pornography, child pornography, producing videos, and participating in the exploits of sexual addiction. So he knew that about his buddy, who was arrested in April. In May, the FBI came and raided his house. And then nothing happened. And I think for a lot of us, we wanted to believe, well, this is not really me, because when the FBI comes to your home, they already have the goods on you. But the general public wanted to believe that it was a mistake or that they were just checking to make sure Jared hadn't participated in any illicit behavior. And at the same time, here's this man who has lots of money, very wealthy, lots of recognition, incredible insight into addiction. You know, it's pretty obvious that he had a process addiction of overeating. He lost, you know, almost a couple hundred pounds when he was in college, eating Subway every single day of his life. And, well, not of his life, but about 1 year period while he was at IU. So here's a man who understands he has a problem. The FBI come in May, and in June, he's in New York hooking up with 16-year-olds and soliciting minors for sex and for video productions. Okay, that's at least what the news says about him. That is allegedly what he agreed to when he signed a plea bargain. So that talks about how strong that compulsion is to act out, to seek one more sexual experience, and to think that you can talk the FBI, the police, the public out of believing that you have a problem. That fits the profile of a sex addict. You know, sex addicts believe they're invincible. They don't believe they're going to get caught. They believe what they convince themselves of, and they're in horrific denial. And so here's a man with two kids and a wife who lives in the beautiful suburbs of Indianapolis, who has hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, who is the spokesperson for health and well-being, and he has this double life. And you and I both know that sex addicts have a double life. So, four interviews in 3 days on television. And then I make the front paper, the headlines of the front page of the Indianapolis Star as I'm describing, you know, some of Jared's alleged problems. And, you know, what I know to be true is that this is an insidious disorder. You know, lots of people said, hey, I don't even believe sexual addiction exists. And yet, Jared was living proof that that compulsion is alive and well. And if you suffer from that compulsion, there is help out there. You know, get yourself to a certified sexual addictions therapist. You can do that by going to my website, Sex Help with Carol the Coach, or www.sexhelp.com, taking the test, putting your zip code in, and finding out who is the closest professional who can get you started, get you guided in the right place. You know, I don't really do therapy online or Skype, but what I do is I consult with people, and over a period of 3, 4, 5, 6 sessions, I help them to get their life on track. I talk to them about recovery tools. I suggest what is some of the best readings. What are the ways to get help via the internet? You know, what 12-step groups are available, what recovery tools they need. And so I feel really blessed to be able to do that, to be able to help. And, you know, one of the news reporters said to me, Carol, you really do have a passion for this work. And I couldn't agree enough, because I know that you're great people out there. You don't know what to do to get healthy. and it's got to be really, really tough, and I want to be part of the solution. If you love somebody out there and you know he or she has a sexual addiction, I want to be part of your solution too. You know, the one thing I secretly wished was that I could help Mrs. Fogel and or her children, because they're really hurting, and I know what they're going through because I have lived the stories of so many of my clients. I've been with them when they went through it. And, you know, you don't have to be Mrs. Fogel, but, you may be the boyfriend, the girlfriend, the wife, the husband of a sex addict. And what I know to be true is that you're in an incredible amount of pain. So I just want you to know that I'm certainly taking things seriously. And there is help out there. You know, tonight we're going to be talking to a recovery coach, and he's actually going to be encouraging all of the addicts out there to get out of victim consciousness. And he believes, as do I, that when you stay in that victim role, there's not much anybody can do for you, and certainly you for yourself. But when you start practicing a formula for change, and he actually talks about this formula and how important it is in doing work, you too can make a huge difference in your own life. And so it's the experts out there, people that have either lived the addiction or people who have made it their mission to devote their lives to helping others. That's what we're all about, and I'm very, very excited to be talking to this recovery coach, because he has truly lived from the perils of sexual addiction to absolutely making a huge difference in his own life and in the difference of others. Juan, welcome to the show.
Carol, good evening.
Hi there, and boy, I've heard so many wonderful things about you and the work that you're doing, and so I contacted you. I said I want to hear your story, and I want to hear what you're doing with addicts that's making such a difference in their lives. So let me ask you something here. Obviously, I did say that you're a recovering addict. So can you share with us a little bit of your story and what you had to do to overcome it in order to obtain abstinence and then pay it forward?
Great. Thank you for the question. And thank you for the intro. I called in a few moments ahead of the scheduled time, so I did hear a bit of your introduction. And I'm pleased to say that today my life can be defined in many ways by some of the words that you chose to describe me. It was not the way it always was. Primarily because, as you alluded to, I was living in pain and not even aware of it, but I was certainly responding to it through a whole host of maladaptive behaviors that I was so ashamed of, and I had no idea were symptomatic of something that had a name, that something being sexual addiction. I was convinced that what I had was a deeply rooted moral flaw that would mark me and scar me for life. I came to recognize that I was a sex addict on August 7th of 2007. At that time, and on the morning, it was a Tuesday, I remember it well, I was walking out of an operating room of the hospital at which I was a physician, and was confronted with a couple of hospital administrators who were there to ask me if the pornography that had been found on a work-assigned computer belonged to me or belonged to someone else. And in that moment, the powerlessness and unmanageability that we talk about in a 12-step program of recovery really just struck me, and I was able to see it for the first time for what it really was. The beginning of my story really goes back many years before, decades before, really. And what I can best describe today as a life of avoidance, and avoidance of pain, avoidance of feeling trapped, avoidance of internal conflicts that I felt powerless to do anything about, and avoidance of my sexuality, which, growing up in a Hispanic family, I grew up in Puerto Rico, was a source of tremendous shame for me. And I was certain, confirmed my worst fear, which was that I was unlovable as my creator had made me. I spent a significant portion of my life avoiding feelings, first with alcohol and drugs in high school, then in college I turned to compulsive studying that allowed me to progress in school while avoiding any appearance of being gay, which is the sexual orientation that I was trying to hide from the world. I was able to get into an Ivy League medical school on the East Coast, and then rapidly progressed through the ranks to become an academic head and neck surgeon, and a clinical researcher, teacher, and administrator of a department at a couple of New York City hospitals. But all the time really ignoring deep pain that would fester, would manifest any time that I stopped paying attention to work. So I was really a workaholic and a sexual anorexic. In 1999, I discovered the internet and very quickly discovered online pornography. And almost immediately, that took over my life. And I began to spend increasing amounts.
Can I ask you, for our listening audience, we have talked about sexual anorexia, but some people are just...
Yeah.
Tuning in for the first or second time, and you said you were sexually anorexic, and I'm sure they're sitting there going, how could a sex addict be sexually anorexic? So A, could you describe what a sexual anorexic is, and B, how that applied to your life, especially since there was so much shame about homosexuality?
Sure. Well, for me, sexual anorexia took the form of avoidance of my sexuality. After a couple of homosexual encounters in high school that were not a source of pleasure, they were, if anything, a source of tremendous guilt and shame, I made the somewhat conscious decision that I was not gay and that I was going to prove it to myself, and in the process, remain safe. My definition of safety, I've come to realize, was dependent on maintaining an unhealthy enmeshment with my mother. My definition of safety included the complete avoidance of sexuality. So from age 18 to my late 40s, I did not have any sexual contact with anyone. I did not pursue sexual contact or sexual intimacy with anyone. I had an active fantasy life and an active masturbation life, but I did not actually date. I did not pursue friendships in the gay community. I used as an excuse the fact that I was busy with my studies, first in pre-med and then in medical school, to avoid any possibility of interacting with other gay men and finding sexual intimacy.
Oh, and it's interesting you said that, because what we know about sexual addiction in general, and it does not sound like you had the addiction at that point, but clearly for so many men and women that participate and are sexually addicted and act out, I do have periods of sexual anorexia because, as you said, there is so much self-loathing and shame that they really say, I'm not going to do that again. I'm going to be abstinent. And then they don't participate in anything sexual for a period of time. They feel like they have control again, and then the addiction takes hold.
That's right. So I went from a period of seeming absolute control, right, to an unleashing of sexual craving that found its manifestation through online pornography, gay pornography, that took over my life. It became it became the most important thing in my life, and I found myself spending increasing amounts of time finding it online. It deepened my isolation. It deepened my shame, by the way, because as much as I pursued it, I also continued to experience the self-loathing and the shame that you have already mentioned. I made multiple attempts to stop, multiple attempts to disconnect from the online world, all of which failed. I made many promises to myself, all of which I broke. Ultimately, I decided the difficulty I was having was explainable on the basis of living in a large metropolis on the East Coast, and I decided what I needed was to change coasts and to change jobs. So I did a classic geographic move to the West Coast, and of course, all of my conflicts and difficulties followed me. And once on the West Coast, the behavior intensified, and I ended up spending time at work looking at online pornography. And here's the thing. Here in California, I worked for a hospital chain that made it very, very clear several times a year to all of their members and employees that they were monitoring the employees' use of their online resources. So I found a way to justify my behavior, believing myself immune to the possibility of ever being discovered. And the consequences were also made very clear for anyone who used the hospital's resources inappropriately.
Sex addict tells him or herself that that is not going to happen to them, or that they don't really mean it. That's just a scare tactic, and they don't think about the consequences of the behavior. Or if they do, the compulsion is so much more prevalent that it takes over.
Right. Absolutely.
Okay. So you had that. You already had that. That warning, as did every employee there, you ignored it.
Yes,
because
correct.
Of the compulsion.
Exactly. Exactly.
Then what happened?
So what happened was, on August 7th, being confronted with the situation I just described, in a moment of clarity, I saw an opportunity to change, and I decided to take it. And I didn't really know what that change was going to look like, because remember, I had no idea that I was suffering from a compulsion. I had no idea that what I was experiencing had a name. And yet, something inside of me impelled me to tell the truth. I could have continued lying. I could have continued living a double life. I had become an expert at compartmentalizing my life, but I made the choice to tell the truth. And as a consequence of that, I ended up losing my job. But almost instantaneously, things began to align themselves in a way that opened the door to a path that I had never even considered, and that was the path of recovery. The very next morning, I decided to call my family, to call my siblings and let them know what had happened. As well, I called the only remaining friends that I had in California. Both of them are in recovery. He from alcohol addiction for many, many years. And it turns out that they knew someone who was in recovery from sexual addiction. They put me in touch with that person. He called. And within 24 hours, I was attending my first meeting of a 12-step recovery program, of which I am a member to this day. And
so you
I was on the path to healing. Excuse me?
Did you lose your...
I did, yes. I am no longer practicing as a physician.
Okay. And, of course, that's the consequences of the behavior and also your honesty. I believe that addicts, when they really get good recovery, they turn their lives around and they figure out how to give back in a different way, and that's what you're doing right now.
That is correct.
Okay, so
that is correct.
What an interesting story. Within 24 hours or 48 hours, you were in the first 12-step meeting.
Within 24 hours, I had found my first 12-step meeting, and you know, and then I began to follow direction. I began to do what I heard other people saying would grant me freedom, and that included attending meetings, and I attended a meeting, at least a meeting a day, for the first 2 years of my recovery. I bought the literature, read it, studied it. I made a commitment to my sponsor. The man who I had been put in contact with became my sponsor during that first week of interaction between he and I. I committed to not acting out no matter what. I got rid of my computer and began to develop new habits, new recovery habits that to this day ground me in my process of recovery. As I said before, daily meetings. I arrived early, stayed late. I shared my truth frequently. I spoke of my shame. I had service commitments at most of my meetings, which is a way of giving back. I surrounded myself day and night with people in recovery. I joined a men's group, the purpose of which was to address the presence of spirituality in our lives. I found a spiritual path to study and pursued it. I developed a morning routine that includes meditation, reading from my spiritual text, reading from recovery literature. I began to make phone calls and to receive phone calls, and I began to be of service to other people in recovery. And
you know,
I thought you were
going to
ask me a question.
Juan. Yeah, well, it is. Yeah. It's so interesting that I talk about if people do the work and they follow at least 8 out of the 10 recovery tools, they almost have no choice but to get healthy. And I just counted, as you were talking, 7 tools, and I'm sure you weren't even finished. You were just citing some of the things. The sponsor,
the
morning that supports your recovery reading and your spiritual reading and the fellowship and making calls
fellowship.
And going to meetings and you got rid of your computer. For some people who don't feel like they can get rid of their computer, at least if they can get the proper filters and have accountability buddies and that kind of stuff, it works when you work it. And you really did a great job of getting right in there and saying, okay, I am going to work this program no matter what.
Yes. And it was, you know, the most difficult thing that I have ever done in my entire life, without a question. More, far more difficult than going to medical school or training to become a surgeon. Because My commitment to safety was grounded in the belief that without what I now call my sexual addiction, I could not survive. And safety trumps everything. So all of these tools, and in particular, the being connected to other human beings who are going through the same process, and developing a spiritual practice that included the finding of a higher power of my understanding. Not the higher power I grew up with as a child, because the God that I learned of as a child was punitive and judgmental and promised infinite punishment for finite deeds. So that was not going to be a higher power that would work for me.
Right.
You're absolutely right. If you work the program works. And the other thing that I did, which I believe is essential, is I almost immediately began to work with professionals. I hired a sex addiction therapist, a CSAT, a certified sex addiction therapist, and coach. And I also worked with a psychotherapist to begin to untangle and understand the origins of the pain that I had been avoiding for so long. So, you know, what I discovered is that, at least for me, what I really suffered from, and suffer from still, if I do not practice my program on a regular basis, on a daily basis, is not the childhood trauma, the neglect, the emotional abuse, the physical abuse, the sexual abuse that I recalled during my therapy and that I experienced as a child, but really what I most suffered from were the decisions that I arrived at about myself as a result of that trauma.
Give
I'm
us
not
an
enough.
Example.
I'm not worthy.
Yeah, okay.
I am not lovable.
And then, of course, you end up, you participate in behaviors through addiction that reinforce that you're not enough, you're unworthy, and you're unlovable.
Exactly. You know, my behaviors served the purpose of deepening my conviction that I was shameful, not worthy, flawed, inadequate, and ultimately unlovable. And of course, the reason for that is that those were the beliefs that granted me a sense of safety and control in the midst of a chaotic childhood environment. So by blaming myself, I found a semblance of safety amidst a family environment that was, you know, intolerable. Unfortunately, those core beliefs that I just mentioned extract a price, and they need to be sustained, as you were just mentioning. And it is out of those negative core beliefs that I believe we develop what I call rules for living, which are, you know, for the people who are trying to change, for the folks in recovery, maybe even some folks on the line right now who are perhaps in recovery and are trying to apply the tools and are struggling with the tools. Well, what I have discovered is that we all have what I call these rules for living that define our unconscious commitment to safety, and which when our commitment to safety opposes any other commitment, such as, say, the commitment to work the steps or the commitment to make phone calls or the commitment to go to fellowship, what I find is that we begin to self-sabotage our commitment to recovery, no matter how sincere. So some of the work I do with my clients, all of whom are people who are in recovery, mostly from sexual addiction, is to uncover and understand those rules for living so that we can then begin the process of gently and compassionately and stepwise, challenging their veracity so that the person can start to live differently.
Sure. Okay, so now one more time, let's go over those rules for living, because I know you have two very important concepts. One is the rules for living, and then two is the victim consciousness. So
correct.
Rules for living, tell us, break those down.
So I'll give you some examples from my own life, from my own experience. But again, the basic idea is that in the face of childhood trauma or family dysfunction, we develop negative core beliefs, negative ideas about ourselves, which grant us a semblance of safety and control. But they do extract a price, and the price is that for us to believe those core beliefs, to connect with their truth, is not comfortable. It's extremely painful. So then we develop these rules for living, the intention of which is to keep the negative core beliefs under the surface, under, you know, away from conscious awareness. And by nature, these rules for living are very, very rigid and very restrictive. So, for example, one of my rules for living is I can't be myself. I can't be me. I can't be authentic. Because when I am unlovable. I am flawed. Surfaces, and I experience intense anxiety.
And do you think
I have to be perfect?
Sexual addiction? Yeah, I was going to say, do you think that prior to sexual addiction, these rules for living occurred and created that workaholism that you seem to be a part of? You know, not only does it sound like you dealt with sexual addiction, but you were also a workaholic.
Right.
That gave you that false sense of, I'm good enough, I'm lovable.
Correct. That is correct.
Okay.
Well, you know, the bottom line is that I'm compulsive.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a tendency, as I explore my life, to do everything compulsively, especially those things that granted me freedom from pain and which distanced me from my negative core beliefs and hence were aligned with my rules for living. One of the things that... So, you know, and we'll get back to perhaps to the topic of rules for living as this part of the topic in a moment. But one of the things that happens when we develop these rules for living is that as we grow older and the world becomes more complicated, it is certain that we're going to be faced with life circumstances that are going to threaten our rules or absolutely break them. And then what we do in the face of increasing anxiety is we either avoid, escape, or we over-prepare. So a manifestation of my rule for living, which was I need to be, well, two other rules for living that are my rules. I have to be perfect, and I can't be ordinary. If I satisfy those rules, then I am not in touch with the core belief that says I am unlovable. And in some way, I hope then that I will get the love and affection that I so desired as a child but never received, at least to the extent that I wanted it when I was a child. So what do I do when confronted with a life situation that ensures that that I'm not going to be perfect, that I'm not going to have all the answers, that I am not going to be extraordinary? Well, I over-prepare, and hence the emergence of my workaholism. If, you know, I'm laughing because I remember one of my interviews when I was in the process of pursuing residency training in head and neck surgery, I remember telling one of the physicians who was interviewing me at one of the medical centers I went to that I told them, I am not going to promise that I am the hardest worker, but you will never find someone who works harder than me.
Uh-huh.
And that, I now realize, was very much a manifestation of that workaholism born of, you know, my rules for living.
Right, which again is I'm not really good enough, so if I work really, really hard, I'll be worth something to you, and you'll love me.
Exactly. Now, that, you might say, at least had some functional outcome to it, right? I mean, I'm working, I am studying, I am developing a profession, but there were other times when my rules for living actually got in the way, such as I remember clearly a time when I was in medical school and in my third year of medical school when you're no longer taking written tests, you're involved in doing clinical work and you're being assessed on the basis of your performance in a clinical setting. And I was about to arrive at a class where I learned on my way to the class that there existed a possibility that I might be singled out by the professor and called up to the front of the room to interpret a radiograph. And this was a task that I wasn't prepared for. And in any event, it's not a task you can over-prepare for, because learning how to interpret radiographs is something that takes a lifetime to develop, and it's really an art form. So without knowing what was happening, I found myself coming up with a good reason why I should avoid that class that day. So I avoided a situation in which my rule for living, meaning I have to be perfect, I can't be ordinary, was about to be potentially threatened, if not broken. So that was a form of avoidance. Another time, I actually made it to the class. But halfway through the class, the anxiety became so extreme that I feigned illness and was able to exit the class. And that was a pattern that would repeat itself many, many times during the course of my life in a way that would leave me dumbfounded and also deepened my shame. But today I realize that,
no, well, I was just going to say, I was thinking to myself, you know, obviously, when you've had childhood issues that involve neglect and abuse, and then you couple that with that ego dystonic, if you will, feeling of, I shouldn't have this form of sexuality. There's something wrong with me.
Right.
You then create these rules of living that negate all those negative feelings that you have, and you either run from them as much as you can, or you run towards them and prove yourself. And, you know, you probably wouldn't have been a doctor, but you were following the rules of living. Yeah.
Correct.
Okay, so
I was also following,
No, go ahead. You were also following.
I was going to say that I was also following a the choice of career was not, and by that I mean a medical career, was not a choice that I think derived from an innate love of the profession. It was a choice that I made to satisfy a maternal prerogative. And you know, one of the internal conflicts that fueled my sexual acting out once I discovered internet pornography, and which has to do with the one bugaboo we haven't spoken about yet, victim consciousness, is that I felt trapped in a profession that perhaps I loved, but a job that I hated. And by that I mean, I experience a need to not just be an ordinary physician, but I had this need to excel. and to achieve and to pursue additional trainings and additional certifications, etc. And, you know, it got to the point where I felt like I was trapped in a situation that was not under my control and that I could not change. And that led to a great deal of anger and resentment, which I was able to discharge in part through, you know, viewing online pornography.
Got it.
So let's and that is one of the hallmarks of victim consciousness.
Oh, I was going to say, that's what I would have thought. So explain that concept and where that came from in your own life.
Well, victim consciousness, first of all, is a mindset through which the person who experiences life through victim orientation filters everything. All of their perceptions are filtered through that mindset. And there are several characteristics that someone who's experiencing life in victim consciousness will display. First of all, it's a lack of self-responsibility. When you're in victim consciousness, you do not feel that you are responsible for the things that are happening in your life. Your inner state, your joy, your happiness, or other feelings are at the mercy of things that are outside of you. We tend to blame others and to accuse others. We enter into relationships that are ruled by a dynamic that Stephen Cartman defined in 1968, which with his famous Cartman or drama triangle. And what he described was a way of a relational dynamic in which there's only three possible roles for the people who are involved in this dynamic, and the roles are victim, rescuer, or perpetrator. And in fact, you know, you play all three roles in any interaction with another person who's willing to play, who enter into a drama relationship with you. But first and foremost, you feel disempowered and you feel incapable of making changes in your life. You feel incapable of stating clearly and directly what your wants and needs are. You learn to discharge your anger through acts of perpetration, through acts of aggression or passive aggression, and not believing that your needs have merit or that your needs will ever be met, you become a rescuer in an attempt to manipulate others into a relationship of obligation in which hopefully your needs then get met. But when they don't, you feel resentful and entitled, and you then become aggressive or passive-aggressive. And that certainly was part of my experience as well. Feeling trapped in a profession that I, or at least in a job that I did not want, but feeling incapable of making the necessary changes to align my job with who I really was. Instead, I sought out to act out my feelings.
Okay, so then wouldn't you say that addicts always have this kind of victim consciousness before recovery?
All addicts are victims. All of them. All, in my experience, all addicts experience life through victim consciousness. Now, you know, it's not black or white, of course. Victim consciousness exists along a spectrum. And in fact, you know, most people alive today spend some time coming in and out of victim consciousness. There's a gentleman, a psychologist at Harvard, Robert Kagan, who's done studies using questionnaires, validated questionnaires that he's submitted to thousands upon thousands of college-age sophomores across the country. And through that tool, he's discovered that approximately 80% of people at any given time are experiencing life through the lens of victim consciousness. So victim consciousness is very, very pervasive. But of course, just because it is pervasive doesn't mean it is normal. And to your point, in my estimation, every single addict experiences life through the lens of victim consciousness before they get into recovery. Now, the corollary is, and this is a program aphorism, is that victims don't recover. So you have to address your victim consciousness and its various manifestations if you are to achieve not only abstinence, but long-lasting abstinence. If you're able to maintain your sobriety, not for a week, a month, a year, but for the rest of your life.
Okay, so how do you guide
how do you do that?
People work out of that system of consciousness? Because I have a feeling...
Right.
It's a combination of some of those recovery tools that we talked about, as well as a mindset,
yes.
a kind of an accountability, responsibility mindset.
Exactly. You can't help but faithfully work a program of recovery. And as you were saying earlier, work at least eight or so tools, but especially you can't help and work all 12 steps and make the steps a part of your life and not be working on victim consciousness simultaneously. Many of the steps demand the kind of self-examination and self-responsibility, which is the hallmark of life outside of victim consciousness. But there's other factors as well. As you know, a 12-step program of recovery is a spiritual solution to whatever addiction is being addressed in the particular program. And the reason I believe that that is important and developing a spiritual life within your recovery is so important has to do with the following metaphor that I like to use with some of my clients. Life in victim consciousness is as if your entire existence was reduced to a different universe, which is populated by laws that dictate what is possible in that universe. So, for example, life on a two-dimensional plane is ruled by the laws of Euclidean geometry. And if I was living in a two-dimensional plane, I might look around and I might look at myself and I might think, I'm a simple shape, I'm a circle, I'm a triangle, I'm a square. I might look around me and find other simple shapes, flattened circles and rectangles, or lines even. One of the laws of Euclidean geometry, as you and all the listeners probably remember, is that parallel lines do not intersect. So if you live in a two-dimensional universe, you better not, and you're a line, you better not fall in love with a parallel line because you'll never intersect, you'll never touch. But the moment you recognize that there is an added dimension that you previously were unaware of, you suddenly realize that, wait a moment, I'm not a circle, I'm a sphere. I'm not a square, I am a rectangle.
Mm-hmm.
You now enter a higher dimensional universe with a different set of laws that rule the interactions within that universe. And, you know, something magical can happen, such as if you look at the map of the world, the lines of longitude at the equator are parallel, but at the poles, they actually intersect.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
People in the audience might be thinking, well, yes, fantastic, I get that, but we already are living in a three-dimensional world. What is this higher order dimension that you're talking about that might free us from victim consciousness? And I believe that that dimension is the dimension of spirituality. So I believe that it is essential to experiencing life as a creator rather than as a victim, to experience life as self-responsible, to engage in a life that is inclusive of spiritual study and spiritual practices.
Okay, and again, is this your concept that you have extracted from the triangle theory, or can our listeners read about this somewhere?
Absolutely. There are, let me reach over to my library, and I can direct listeners to a couple of texts. One of them is the work of Stephen Cartman, which, of course, you'll find online. I'm trying to find his website. In any event, if you Google Stephen Cartman, K-A-R-P-M-A-N, you will find a tremendous treasure trove of resources on victim consciousness. In addition to that, I have found a couple of other people who are really eloquent and articulate in their discussion of victim consciousness. One of them is Lynn Forrest, L-Y-N-N-E, F-O-R-R-E-S-T. And if you Google her, you'll find her website. And the second or the third resource is the work of David Emerald, E-M-E-R-A-L-D. And in particular, he's written a wonderful book called The Power of TED. And TED, in addition to being a name, someone's name, is also an acronym for the Empowerment Dynamic, which is his antidote for victim consciousness or victim orientation. Now, I have read, you know, all of that material, and in essence created a methodology, if you will, which is a mix of all of that and also my own experiences, my ongoing experiences in my work to rid myself of my own victim consciousness.
Okay, well, I know we're getting towards the end of the show, and that was very, very helpful. Do you have a computer now, or are you still choosing to be computer and laptop free?
No, I have a computer now. Thankfully, I'm no longer compelled to look at pornography, and in fact, I'll just share with you in the audience, I celebrated 8 years of sobriety on August 7th of 2015, and I'm very, very thrilled and happy for that, and it has transformed my life. And the obsession to search for pornography is no longer part of my daily experience. I can work with a computer, I can work in an unsupervised environment with my computer without a without that compelling desire that previously consumed me.
Fantastic. And then one last thing, if people would like to work with you, are you available
Yes.
to work with them as the recovery coach? How can they get a hold of you?
Absolutely. I am available. They can reach me through my website, www.recoverysolutionslifecoaching.com.
Mm-hmm.
They can also reach out to me directly. I'll give you my phone number,
okay,
which is area code 310-779-6149.
Well, Juan, thank you so very much. I mean, your story is incredible, and the tools that you're using ensure success. So I know you give hope, strength, and recovery to my listening audience, and I wish you the best.
Carol, thank you for the invitation, and thank you for the wonderful work that you're doing. We'll talk again soon.
Excellent. I would love that. Bye. You have a great night.
Yes. You bet.
All
bye-bye.
Right. So that was one. Obviously, an incredible recovery coach, has a lot of experience himself, and is really working the work, and it obviously does work. And you can email me if you need that information and you want to get a hold of him. And as I have to end for today, it's already the end of the show, so listen. As I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times. I fearlessly want you to have the courage to be yourself, to do the work, and to know that not only can you work through the problems and the issues that accompany sexual addiction, you can also be the best person ever. That's my guarantee to you if you do the work. Have a great week, and we'll catch you next Monday night for more Sex Help with Carol the Coach.